Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 16th, 2013. It is so nice to be with you today. But to be completely honest, I was dreading it a little because today's show is all about the conversations that make you squirm. Like when your sister asks to borrow money, or you have to suggest to your parents that they sell their house to pay for retirement, or figuring out, can we afford to have kids? So what's the most difficult conversation you've ever had with a loved one about money?
My name is Chuck Kushla. It was the week before I was about to leave for college, and I had kept a summer job, and I was supposed to be saving all of my money for school, and I didn't save any of it. And so the hardest conversation I had was when my mom took me to the bank to pick up all of my savings, and then there wasn't any, and so I had to ask her for money then, and I would have to say we probably had that conversation a few more times.
And that's the thing about those money conversations. Like Chuck just said, they're an ongoing ordeal. And most people would do anything they can to avoid talking about money with their relatives. But that wasn't my experience growing up, to be honest. My father was fixated on money. He was also a big fan of aphorisms. One of his favorites was, "People don't plan to fail, they fail to plan." And he planned. He planned ahead so thoroughly that we kids didn't have to do that much when our parents got older. But talking to your parents about their finances and their planning for retirement and beyond is a very important conversation. It can also be a very delicate one. And we're going to start our show with that today. Tara Siegel Bernard is a personal finance reporter with the New York Times. Welcome, Tara.
Nice to be here.
Well, there never seems to be a good time to talk about money with family. So when should you first initiate this conversation with your parents?
The sooner the better, because nobody knows how much time they have. And, you know, I recently spoke with a family that thought they had plenty of time, and then their mother died unexpectedly. They didn't know that their mother had a mortgage. And once they figured out that she did have a mortgage, it was already in default. It's always better to start as soon as you can. Not everybody's willing to talk about it or have that money conversation because it is such an emotional topic.
Well, it seems as if how you phrase things is the most important thing. What advice can you give us on how this topic can best be approached?
Sure. Well, you don't want to put anybody on the defensive. You know, don't say, you know, you're disorganized, you're going to make this so difficult for me. You want to kind of spin that around and use I statements like, you know, I'm really concerned about doing the right thing. How can we approach this together? Another idea is if they don't want to talk to you, the child, about their financial situation, you know, you might suggest tagging along to their, you know, trusted accountant's office the next time they go to do their taxes, just to kind of get a feel for where things are and how, you know, organized they really are. Or maybe you suggest tagging along to a visit to their financial planner. That's another idea.
What if your parents just balk at the idea completely, or they think it's none of your business?
Right. And a lot of people do think it's none of their children's business. There's also kind of a power dynamic going on. You don't want to, it's kind of like, you know, handing over the keys to your car once you reach a certain point and can no longer drive. It's kind of, you know, ceding control, another aspect of your life. And people might not want to do that. So one of the families that I interviewed a few months ago was talking about how, you know, they didn't have the cash on hand to keep the estate going. If you want to, you know, take care of that in advance, there's a variety of things that you can set up. You might not want to give your children access to your bank accounts right away, but you can set them up in such a way that, you know, after the second spouse dies or after the parent dies, it's a payable on death account. So, you know, it would go to the child. That's one way to kind of just have a little pot of cash to, you know, keep the mortgage going, to pay the bills, do, you know, whatever needs to be taken care of.
So that's something parents can do proactively to make the whole process easier for their kids.
Right, exactly.
And here's a really practical question. Just getting together all the paperwork can be so hard after your parents die. Where should people store their paperwork, and what paper should they organize so that their kids can easily access it?
I've been told that keeping things in a safe deposit box, that's the first place where people would think, oh, we'll just put it all in the safety deposit box and it'll be safe. But everybody that I spoke to, all the legal experts, elder care attorneys, said that's probably the worst place to store it. Because when you think about it, there's no inherent value to the actual pieces of paper. Once the parent is no longer there to open up the box, it can get really complicated, and it could take a really long time to get into that safe deposit box. So what you want to do is get what's called a strong box, or some sort of fireproof box that you could put in your house in a safe place. But it's the kind of thing where you can lock it, give your child the key, put the key in a place where they know where to find it, and then they don't have to worry about getting into the bank and into the safe deposit box.
Tara, have you talked with your parents?
You know, they've they have approached me. They're pretty.
And then they're those.
Yes, exactly. They're like, we know that your one sister is just going to be a mess, and so we're going to tell you exactly what we want. But I think the hard work is done. And they're pretty organized about having their passwords in one place and whatnot. So, but there's still, it's not one conversation. Nobody wants to talk about this kind of stuff. You might do a little bit at a time, but yeah, in my case, there's still some issues that need to be ironed out.
Tara Siegel Bernard is a personal finance reporter with the New York Times, and it was great talking with you. Thank you.
Great talking with you too. Thanks so much for having me.
And on our Facebook page, people are sharing advice their parents gave them about money. Donald writes, "My dad always used to say, it's not the high cost of living, it's the cost of high living." It's one thing to talk money with the people you've known your whole life, and it's quite another to tackle this subject with a spouse who grew up in a whole different culture and political climate. You might not speak the same money language. To get some perspective on this, we asked our Facebook friends to tell us about their experiences making financial decisions with spouses from different ethnic or religious backgrounds. This struck a nerve with Elizabeth in Philadelphia. 13 years ago, she married Misha, who grew up in Soviet Russia. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
And Meg Favreau joins us as well. She's the senior editor of the personal finance website Wisebread. Welcome back to the show, Meg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, Elizabeth, tell us about your money clashes with Misha. What don't you folks agree on?
He doesn't seem to want to sit down with me and come up with a budget. I've sort of taken it upon myself to come up with a budget. But when one person is thinking about a budget and then the other person is not, it doesn't work very well.
And what do you think about his background would lead him to shy away from a household budget?
I don't really know. I think it could be that growing up in this sort of maybe protected environment, he said that life was very sort of dreamlike there, and people really, it was very stress-free when it came to thinking about finances and mortgages, and well, there weren't any mortgages. I grew up watching my parents balance their checkbook, get into it about money. And I get this sense that everything was taken care of by either the state or his mother mostly.
Oh, interesting. And do you think he's expecting you to kind of take on that role?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I know that there's no such thing as a stay-at-home mother in Russia. The women both work and hold down the home and children.
So he thinks you have plenty of time to do this, and you're a stay-at-home
and
mom?
Plenty of energy.
Right, right. I'm getting a good sense of what's going on here. Okay, well, Meg, this is the American experience here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the main problem that so many couples have. But so would you say that you have like a lot of shared goals and values?
I would say that we definitely have a lot of shared values. I'm not sure really what our goals are at this point. I mean, we have we're raising our children. We have this, or he has this business, and I help him a little bit with that, but it's mostly him.
So what is the hardest issue then? Is it getting him just to talk about this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. I would say it's the lack of conversation mostly.
I think that the first thing that you should do is you guys should make a time, get a babysitter, sit down and have just a very frank conversation about money. And it shouldn't be a conversation about the nitty-gritty every day, the grocery budget, things like that. It should be a conversation that's about your life goals and your values and what you want to be doing with that sort of stuff. And so I think that maybe if you approached it from this direction, you started the conversation with, all right, here we are. We're obviously in this relationship. We love each other a lot. What are we trying to do with money? And then once you've kind of had that overarching conversation, then you can get down more into the nitty-gritty stuff, the day-to-day budget.
Well, Meg, should Elizabeth really address some of these deep-seated cultural differences that they have, you know, Misha's past experience and how she grew up and what her parents did, or would that just cloud the waters?
I think it's an important thing to discuss, but it's important to discuss it in the context of understanding and both getting him to understand where you're coming from and you understanding where he's coming from. Because anytime that anybody thinks they should change the way somebody else is thinking, it just makes me cringe a little bit. And I'm not saying that's what you were trying to do, but that's one of the hardest things to do.
That way lies madness.
Yeah, exactly. So really, it's about understanding where he's coming from, him understanding where you're coming from, and then finding ways to compromise so you can reach these goals that you're both trying to reach.
Meg, maybe this is an example of a conversation that never ends and shouldn't end in a marriage. It's something you revisit, and maybe you make like a weekly budgeting family meeting.
Yeah, it very much needs to be ongoing, but also it's a conversation that you should structure the time for so it doesn't seep into other parts of your life. Because it's very, very easy for any argument that you have with a loved one to suddenly become an argument about money when it wasn't one.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks so much for calling in, too.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good luck. Meg Favreau is a senior editor of the personal finance website Wisebread, and thank you also for your sound advice.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're spending the hour today on one of the least straightforward topics in personal finance, how to talk to your family members about money. Now, you might have heard me say earlier that my father was obsessed with money and always talking about it. It certainly wasn't taboo in our family. But that didn't make it any easier for me when one of my relatives asked to borrow some money. Borrowing and lending, just one of a number of awkward situations that can divide a family. It's so hard not to alienate people we love when money enters the conversation, right? Economist Diane Lim can relate to this, and she joins us now to offer advice on how to make these discussions about money go a little more smoothly. Hi, Diane. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
Let's talk for a bit, and a little later we're going to take some calls from listeners. But I do want to set some groundworks in talking about lending and borrowing money. Now, say you find yourself in need of a loan, and you do come to the conclusion that it's appropriate to ask a loved one for the money. How should you start the conversation?
Well, this is not just a hypothetical for me. I've been in a position where I've actually asked my own parents for financial help in terms of loaning me some money. And sometimes it's not just a question of coming to the conclusion that maybe going to family is the best option, but sometimes you feel like it's really the only option.
Is that how it felt for you?
It felt like that for me at the time. And I'm not talking about ancient history either, because, you know, I've recently been divorced a few years ago, and it's very expensive to go through a divorce when you have several children. I have four kids, and two of whom are in college. And so, you know, having all these life events happen at the same time and having to pay for lawyers and having to split everything up financially, it's the most financially burdensome thing I ever had to go through. And I hadn't prepared for it. You don't save to get divorced. You don't.
Sure.
It was not something I had put into the budget, you know, and I found myself having to ask my parents for help.
How did you do that? Just what was your icebreaker?
Well, you know, hopefully you have a close relationship with your family member to begin with, such that your family member can kind of figure it out when you might need some help. And maybe they're even the ones to bring up the topic first. Like, for example, if I were talking with my kids, you know, when I'm on the flip side of the situation, when I feel like my kids need help, my college kids need help financially, I bring it up with them first before they ask me. Sometimes you luck out, and that's the way it happens, is the person that's going to help you actually brings it up first. But I think if you're not in that position, you know, it does help to, in my case, the way it made it easier for me to bring up the topic is I figured out how it could be a win-win situation for both of us. This is where I put on my economist hat and just remind people that, you know, the interest rate that most of us pay when we borrow money from the private market is way higher than the interest rate that most people earn when they save in the private market. And so avoiding the private bank and being sort of banking within one's family is actually a win-win situation, in the sense that when it came to my arrangement with my parents, my mom said, it seems like you need some help. We'd like to help you. Well, my mother was basically offering to just give me money. And I said to her, no, I don't want to take any more money from you. But what if we could work out an arrangement where I borrow a certain money from you and I figure out what kind of interest I'm willing to pay and the terms. And that way I can pay you a higher interest rate than you can earn in the rest of your savings and any other option you have for your retirement savings. And I can pay a much lower interest rate than I'd pay if I went to a bank.
So it sounds like you went into that conversation with a very clear idea of your offer, of terms, of what you wanted to get accomplished financially.
Right. And I think that the mistake maybe some people make, and I'm not speaking about this from a financial planning standpoint, but just from my role as a person who's been through this, I think a mistake is if you go into these arrangements with family members without spelling out the terms, thinking that, oh, it's family. I don't have to clarify that this is a loan versus a gift. I don't have to clarify how soon I'm going to pay them back and what kind of schedule and interest rate I'm effectively going to be paying them. So I think it's very important to spell out the terms, because if you don't talk to your family members and establish that understanding before the transaction is made, I think you're setting yourself up in the future for bitterness and, you know, grudges that will be held. And I was very grateful to my parents. And I think that the combination of that gratitude from me plus a higher interest rate they could earn elsewhere was very appealing to them.
Well, this is great. I feel like you've really set the scene now for our callers. And we do have a couple of them on the line today who'd love some advice on how to talk to their relatives about money issues. Our first caller is Catherine in Tallahassee, Florida. Hello, Catherine.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, just great. Welcome to the show. So I understand you're preparing to reveal some big news to your daughter. Why don't you tell us what's going on?
Right. I have a daughter who has graduated from college, and I have a uniform gift to minors account that she is now old enough. She's reached the age that it needs to be turned over to her. And I think there's like, I don't know, 12, 13, 14. I haven't looked at the balance recently, but it's a sizable amount that was left over from her undergraduate degree. And I know I have to turn it over to her, but I'm very apprehensive because I have a fear that she will blow it all.
What makes you think that she'll blow it all? Tell us about your daughter. Is she responsible, or how well does she handle money?
Well, she has had some part-time jobs, but she is still fairly dependent on myself and her dad for support. And I mean, she's generally pretty responsible. I guess it's just the fact of getting a windfall all at once. And I guess maybe I'm reflecting my fear. I inherited some money about when I was her age, and I kind of ran through it.
Oh, really? How much did you get?
I don't know. This was like 30 years ago, so it might have been like $3,000, $5,000, $6,000. I don't know what that would be in 2013 dollars, but you know, I had never had that kind of money before, and I just kept buying stuff, you know. And
sure.
One day I looked around, and it was almost gone. And I just really hate to see that happen, because that money would have come in useful if I had just, like, spent a little of it and then kind of nurtured it and saved it for, you know, future house down payment or, you know, to purchase a car or something, instead of just sort of frittering it away.
I bet Diane has some ideas for you, but I just have one more question. Does your daughter have any idea this money is coming her way?
No, Okay. No, I mean, it was money I put, you know, I started when she was born, I started saving it, and I've used most of it for her, you know, for her undergraduate. But she got some scholarships and such that I didn't need to use as much as I thought I would.
Oh, well, good for both of you. Diane, yeah. Catherine is all yours. What do you think?
Well, I also have a 21-year-old daughter. She's my oldest. Catherine, I think you should tell your daughter your own story of your inheritance and what you just told us. You know, it's a great kind of life lesson. It's perfect. I mean, I think that you are doing what I do a lot with my own daughter, which is I project a lot. Like, you know, I've done this in the past, and so she's going to do it too. And I would like to think that all of us moms, we can have our daughters do better than we did if we tell our daughters all the mistakes we made as when we were their age. And with this amount of money that your daughter can take charge of, I mean, I think it's, first of all, it's tremendous news for her, but maybe when you let her know about this, you can also sit down with her and say, how can I help you, Catherine? How can I help you, my daughter, your daughter, make the most of that money? Like, how can you make it last the longest or contribute to something that's going to last her a while, such as saving up for a down payment on a house eventually? And how can you tell her your story of your own inheritance where you now seem to have some regret that you didn't save it for a better use? You know, the other approach is, I suppose, if you really feel like you don't trust her, and I think I would have this conversation before you come to that conclusion, but if you really feel like you want more control over how your daughter uses that money, I mean, I think it's possible for you to give it to her in installments instead of necessarily all at once. But I think the best case scenario is you sit down with your daughter, give her the great news that there's this chunk of money that she's going to be able to take control of, and develop a plan with her about how she's going to use it and how long she's going to make it last.
Catherine, have you told your story to your daughter?
No, I've never. It's never really come up, I guess. When I bring it up, I'm going to bring that up to her because when I did kind of blow through the money, I then had to go to a family member to ask for some money.
Right.
Oh. And it was a very humbling experience.
Well, this sounds like a long and good conversation.
Yeah, it will be a good conversation. Yes.
You know, I had a friend who blew, not an inheritance, actually. She got money from a lawsuit, and she always said she blew it on sunglasses and scarves. And now every time I want to buy a scarf or sunglasses, I think of her and I don't buy it. So
sounds like a lot of sunglasses and scarves.
She was very well accessorized. Well, Catherine, good luck. And your daughter, she's really lucky to have a mom like you. I hope that conversation goes really well.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Diane, we have another caller coming up. But first, we're going to take just a really quick break. Will you stick around? We'll be right back.
Sure.
My guest this hour is economist Diane Lim, and we're talking about how to have those tough conversations with our loved ones about money. And Diane, we have Sam on the line from right nearby in Pasadena, California. How's it going, Sam?
It's going well. How are you?
Just great. Thanks for coming on Marketplace Money. And I'm looking at my notes right now, and I see you wrote to us about being conflicted about having a conversation with your parents about finances. What's going on with them financially?
Well, my father was laid off about 4 years ago from his job, and he was a few years shy of getting a pension that I know he was looking forward to getting. And now him and my mom are kind of living what I think is a pretty precarious financial lifestyle. My mom doesn't have a lot of steady work, and my dad is, I think, trying to find work where he can. And I'm just concern. They've got some property investments that they made back during the real estate boom of some houses in Florida that aren't worth the same amount of money that they were. And I kind of think they're living in a house that's probably too expensive for them now. And just concerned about, you know, what the future holds for them and making sure that they have a long and happy life and get to enjoy time with their new granddaughter.
Oh, I bet a lot of people listening can relate to some of the story that you just told us here. Now, you're married.
Yes.
Yeah. So is your wife going to be involved in this conversation with your parents?
She wants to be. She kind of has told me in the past that we don't want to be in a position where, you know, we're supporting my parents into their elderly years. And I very much agree with her. I don't feel like that's the position I want to be in. But at the same time, I'm kind of conflicted. I want to make sure that they're happy. They've done so much to give me a good life.
How much have you talked with your parents about their financial situation in the past, and how have those talks gone?
We've tried to talk with them. I think my parents kind of have a very different life than I've had. I'm kind of a professional engineer, and my parents, I think, grew up in the 60s and 70s and have a different outlook on kind of corporate America, I guess. And We tend to, I think we're almost speaking different languages when we start talking about finances, things that I consider kind of basic understandings of interest and taking out loans or having good credit don't seem to resonate the same way with them. So my wife and I tend to get frustrated and really not want to continue the conversation. I think at the same time, my parents seem to get a little bit defensive because they don't want to seem like they're maybe projecting that they're in a bad spot to me.
So they're coming more from the hippie end of things?
And definitely.
You're the responsible engineer of flower children?
Kind of Alex P. Keaton incarnate.
Oh, Diane, this is a good one for you. What's your advice for Sam about what to say and maybe much more importantly, how to say it?
Sam, how are they living near you now?
That's another tough part. They actually live in the Northeast.
Wow.
You know, we'd like to have them come out and move out here, but property values, there's a big differential there.
Right. And do you know if they're in a lot of debt?
They are. You know, we've actually kind of talked to them about where they're at. And we've talked about if they liquidated everything and if they were to relocate to California, how that would work out. And it does not seem like a very good situation, at least in my retirement planning lens. They would only be a few hundred thousand dollars, which they're only in their early 60s, and I don't think that's enough to continue into their 80s.
Well, I'm kind of wondering if there's a way you can emphasize the positive when you have a conversation with them and that, like, make it more of a kind of family strategy to, you know, get all of you into a better place. I mean, basically, if your parents stay in New England and you're in California and they're continuing to live beyond their means, eventually that's going to be your financial burden, not theirs. And I would suggest that you frame it in that you want everyone to kind of you want to find a way for you to help them out and for them to help you out a bit. And, you know, start talking to them and asking them questions about whether they think about moving into a smaller place, whether they'd like to come live near you. I mean, once you sort of have a goal in mind that's emphasizing the positive, like, you know, a new place to live and more time with family, maybe that will motivate them more to look at what would be required financially to make that move. You know, it might be that it doesn't have to be like, oh, you're living in too big of a house. It could be, you know, oh, wouldn't you love to come live in a cute little place closer to me in California? And start with a goal instead of, you know, a punishment. It won't put them on the defensive as much because it'll be more like, let's think of this new goal for us as a family. Let's try to get you into a better place physically and financially. But instead of saying like you're living beyond your means, emphasize the new place they're going to be instead of getting out of the situation they're in right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're actually just in town right now to visit their new granddaughter, so I probably won't talk about it with them on this visit. But I think going forward, we are going to start talking more heart to heart with them, and I know with the new grandbaby out here, they want to spend more time out here. So maybe that's a good catalyst to get them to really think about all the positives about moving out here.
Yeah.
Well, good luck. Thanks so much for reaching out to us here at Marketplace Money. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, Diane, this is so tough, but I think all of us have a better idea how to have these conversations now. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Barbara.
Diane Lim is an economist based in Washington, D.C., and formerly author of the blog Economist Mom. And on Facebook, check out the personal finance advice being passed down from the parents of our listeners. Heather's mom told her, enjoy the silver, china, and other nice things you have now. Don't save them for the second wife. There's a backstory there for sure. Want to share some of the money lessons you learned as a child? Leave a comment for us on Facebook, or you can tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank. One of the biggest line items in a family budget is kids. So it should come as no surprise that many people are opting out of starting a family. America's birth rate is now at 1.9%. That's its lowest level since 1920. Now, there are a lot of reasons behind this, but many people feel they just can't afford it. And the conversations leading up to that decision, they can be the toughest of all. Our Facebook friends Tyler and Jenny are in the midst of this right now. Tyler lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota with his partner Nicholas. Jenny, her husband Matt, and their 2-year-old daughter live in Murray, Kentucky. Jenny and Tyler, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny, as I mentioned, you have one child, but you thought you would have more down the line before your daughter was born, I understand. And now you and your husband have had to take a step back. What happened?
Well, my husband is currently going to college. He's using his GI Bill, and he graduates in December, and I work for a nonprofit, and we're in our early 30s, and we kind of made the hard decision to go ahead and actively have a child, which was a great decision, and I'm so glad we have our little girl, but the way things are now, money is so tight, and we just think it would be financially irresponsible to actively work to have our second child right now.
So when you decided to have your daughter, were you certain you could afford her?
Not really.
Is it your experience having your 2-year-old that has kind of pushed you over the edge in terms of just how expensive it is to have and raise a child?
Yeah, I think so.
Things got real?
Yeah, things got really real really quickly. And I mean, it's been hard.
Now, Tyler, you and your partner, Nicholas, don't have a child yet. You've been together for 8 years, I see, and you've thought about having children for a long time. But you recently faced some hard realities.
The reality that we recently started looking at the possibility of having kids. And I was fortunate to be able to attend a workshop that talked about surrogacy. And I was shocked to learn that it can be as little as $25,000 to $30,000 up to $100,000 or more per child. And even infant adoption costs between $15,000 and $20,000. So those were some numbers that were quite difficult to face. And you've got some guaranteed expenses once you have a child, and it's even more difficult to figure out how to prioritize saving for an upfront expense like that when you're guaranteed to have financial costs for the next 18 to who knows how many years down the line.
So how have the talks gone between you and Nicholas when you discussed this decision to delay parenthood or possibly put it off altogether?
It's difficult to overcome thinking about the financial aspects, in spite of the fact that we're both teachers. We both deeply care about children, and children are something that we prioritize in our life already, but we would love to have children of our own.
So how does the conversation go, and how do you handle talking about it?
I am much more comfortable discussing financial issues than Nicholas, so he thinks less about the finances than I do.
So what does he say? I mean, does it get really tough? Does he say things like, how could you just talk about dollars and cents? We're talking about our kids.
It doesn't get heated because I think that he realizes it's not something that can happen in the near term. It's only when we talk about the sacrifices that we would have to make now for something in the longer term. Sometimes looking at things longer term can be difficult.
Jenny, what about you? What about your conversations with Matt? Does one of you feel more strongly than the other about having another child?
Yeah, since we had our first child, I think my husband has continued to have baby fever. And so he's anxious to have another child more than I am. And I'm the one who pays all of our bills and takes care of all of our financial side. And so I'm always looking at those numbers every month going, because I have student loan debt. He's about to have student loan debt when he graduates in December. We also, we still rent. When I became pregnant, we were actively looking for a house. But that also was just not financially feasible.
Well, what's it like for you to be the financial tough love person?
It's hard. I don't like it. and I feel torn because I mean, my maternal instinct is strong too. And I love our child and I'd love to have another one, but somebody has to, kind of put their foot down and say, we just can't do that right now.
Jenny, Tyler, thank you so much for talking with us today. And I hope we can check in with you in a few years and see where you are with this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And all of you can join this conversation about the financial decision to delay having children on our Facebook page right now, or you can send us a message by visiting marketplacemoney.org. A good book helps start a great family conversation. And so this summer, we're sharing book picks from folks in finance.
I'm Jordan Goodman, author of Master Your Debt and editor at MoneyAnswers.com. My favorite personal finance book this summer is The Business of Me by Linwood Bailey. Bailey takes you step by step through the process of defining what career will make you happiest and then how you should go about getting or creating a job that fits that description. I find that so many people are lost when it comes to what they want to do for a career, and therefore they end up in jobs that they hate or that aren't going to lead anywhere satisfying. Bailey says the best way to start is to create your personal brand that makes you unique and that offers value to an employer which will help their business grow. It's hard enough to get a job in this economy, so I think taking a look at Linwood Bailey's The Business of Me will give you a leg up on launching a fulfilling and lucrative career.
I'm Laura Adams, the host of a podcast called Money Girl on iTunes. As a personal finance expert, I've read or skimmed just about every book about money. One that really stands out for me is Multiple Streams of Income, How to Generate a Lifetime of Unlimited Wealth by Robert Allen. I love this book and think it should be on everyone's summer reading list because if you read it with an open mind, it truly can change your life. For many people, the secret to building wealth and breaking out of a debt cycle is really simple. Here's what it is. Earn more money. Saving money is great, and that's always a smart financial move. But there's a ceiling on how much you can save, right? On the other hand, there's no limit to how much you can earn. Multiple streams of income will help open your eyes to all the many ways you can make more money, enjoy your work, and have a happier, more secure financial future.
And you can find the entire list from our series at marketplacemoney.org. Usually, we start talking about money when we don't have enough. Jessie Spector has a very different reason. She feels she has too much. Jessie inherited a little more than $500,000 from her grandparents. So far, she's given away about a third of it and plans to give away most of the rest in the next few years. She's 26 years old, and she's the executive director of Resource Generation. That's a nonprofit which works with wealthy young people to invest in social change. Jessie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, to put your decision in some context, and since we're really getting down to the nitty gritty here on the show, what's your net worth right now?
Currently, it's somewhere around $300,000.
Okay, so you receive $500,000. How much are you giving away?
I'm probably going to give away about $400,000 of that or so.
Who are you giving the money to?
I'm giving the money to dozens of mostly small grassroots-based organizations throughout the United States that are doing a variety of work organizing around LGBTQ issues, economic justice issues, racial justice issues.
Well, growing up, how did your family talk about money and the prospect of you inheriting it? And did that in any way, your background influence your decision to do this?
Very much so. I'll start off by saying that my parents both actively set an example around both generosity and also organizing for progressive social change. Some of my earliest memories are my dad hosting fundraisers and letter-writing campaigns in our house for progressive political candidates. And I also would say that in terms of discussion about wealth in my house growing up, we spoke about the day-to-day very transparently. And then the place that there was not a lot of conversation until I got to be older, until I got to be in my late teens and early 20s, was actually directly about the inheritance I was to receive from my grandparents. When I was around 18, I found out that when I was going to turn 21, I would inherit these several hundred thousand dollars from my grandparents. And up until that point, I didn't have any concept of what that amount of money was.
And why do you think your parents didn't tell you about this inheritance?
I think they did not want me to develop a warped sense of myself or my economic standing or my money. I think that, like most people in society, it's very difficult to talk about money with your children, for my parents included.
Well, how do you think you would think about money differently if they had talked to you more about it?
When I found out I was inheriting several hundred thousand dollars, my immediate thought was, that is so much money. I couldn't even imagine how much money that was. And I wish that I had been able to do some of that processing earlier. There was a moment where I remember that some of my older cousins were inheriting money as well. And I remember hearing that they were inheriting money and being told that I would get some someday and I'd find out more details later on. I was maybe 13 or 14. And the idea of there being a secret about something that was happening in my future, I didn't like very much. I wanted to know.
Well, when you decided to give your inheritance away, how did you tell your family about it?
We had a series of conversations, and we continue to have conversations. I think it was somewhat of a slow growth, and also I was a bit of a reactive, defiant young person, and my parents dealt with me very well and graciously. And we had some back and forth where I said, this is way too much money. I don't need this money. It feels like money that's not mine. So I want to just give it all away immediately. And my parents were respectfully but firmly like, well, it is yours. You can ultimately make whatever decision you want. We encourage you to think over at least a few years' time about this and make sure that ultimately you're coming from a place of thoughtful, rational, comprehensive thinking about where and how to give your money, save your money. Maybe don't react so quickly based on so much of your feelings.
You know, as a parent, I'm thinking they must be so proud of you. But also, they're probably thinking, and have they said this? What about when you, do you want to have kids? What about then?
We've definitely talked about that. It's an ongoing conversation. I do not know yet if I want to have children. And I think that ultimately, even if I were to give away every cent that I inherited, I still have all of the privilege of fantastic lifetime of education, no debt. Even without a cent of inherited wealth, I still feel fairly secure that I would be able to provide a fairly stable life for children.
Well, I know you're still not sure if you're going to have those kids, but say you do, what kinds of conversations do you think you'll be sure to have with them?
People get really stressed when talking about money, and I do for sure as well. And I think the first and foremost thing that I want to bring is an openness and relaxedness to be really honest about money and wealth and poverty and injustice as well from a very early age and not shield anyone from anything.
Jesse Spector is the executive director of Resource Generation, an organization that works with wealthy young people to use their resources for social change. It was really good to talk with you, Jesse. Good luck.
Likewise. Thanks very much.
Before we go, let's face it, money problems and family, that combo makes for some great comedy. Just look at the TV show The Simpsons. For nearly 25 years, you could say it's been America's leading personal finance sitcom. It's got it all. Bad investing, terrible budgeting, mortgage mishaps. Michael Price is a TV writer and producer for The Simpsons. Michael, it's so nice to have you here.
Thank you, Barbara. I'm really happy to be here.
You know, some of my favorite lines are from Homer talking about money and things like, son, if you really want something in this life, you have to work for it. Now, quiet. They're about to announce the lottery number.
Yeah.
Now, maybe this is just a convention, a comedy convention, but it always seems like he's half right about money.
Yeah. I think ultimately Homer, his heart is in the right place. You know, he wants to do well by his family. I think he's not, we all know he's not sort of the smartest guy ever. That line you quoted is a classic line of like all of America, you know, because you want to work hard, but then, you know, you also want something for free.
You know? That's exactly at the root of all of our personal finance problems. We know what we're supposed to do, but doing it.
Right.
Please. It's
right.
So hard.
There's a line I love, too, where Homer was complaining once about his life. And he said, oh, man, I have 3 kids and no money. I wish – why can't I have no kids and 3 money? I think that – you know, I think Homer is a guy that doesn't really think beyond sort of the day-to-day sometimes. You know, so he often makes choices that aren't good for the long term.
But how sensitive a subject is money for you guys? I mean, obviously it's a sensitive subject, especially talking with family members, which
right,
is
of course.
The topic of our show.
Yeah.
But have you had storylines come up that you've had to scrap because it was just too much or it got to a place that didn't strike the right tone anymore?
We'll scrap a story if we don't find it funny. Money is always a huge problem, you know, with families especially. So it's great fodder for us because Homer always wants to sort of go off and do the grand thing, you know, and Marge is the one sort of pulling him back and saying, no, we've got to be careful.
Which is a classic dilemma in families, in marriages.
Absolutely. Which did lead to a great show called Mobile Homer, which was from several years ago, where Marge's penny pinching got Homer so upset that it, at an act of sort of just aggression, he went out and bought a mobile home, a giant RV that he kept in the backyard. it's because conflict, you know, is the basis of, you know, of all drama, you know, and comedy. So having a sort of a family, you know, financial problem, it's a great story, a great way to get our characters interacting with each other. So,
well, in terms of your characters interacting with each other, you know, on our show today, we're talking about how adult kids should approach their aging parents about their finances. Or what if you and your spouse have very different attitudes towards money, as
yes.
you were just saying. So how would you go about writing a scene in which, say, Lisa and Bart have to approach Homer and Marge about their financial situation or planning for their retirement?
Well, I imagine Lisa would probably be very, you know, have done all her research, has probably, you know, read several books about it or, you know, consulted websites or listened
or,
to.
Or she'll quote Camus.
Absolutely. You know, I'm sure she's an active listener of this program. So, and whereas you might have a reasoned argument, you know, Bart would probably just say like, hey, man, just make up, you know, he would say something really that would just get Homer upset, you know, maybe while Homer's strangling him, then he would find a way to pick Homer's pocket or something like that.
Michael Price is a television writer and producer of The Simpsons. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time, our month-long series on the American dream. Up first, no surprises here, home ownership. Write us your stories about real estate on our Facebook page or at marketplacemoney.org. And keep in touch with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Paranada, and help this week from Shay Huffman. Chris Clark is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Barbara Bogave. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is APM.